Dalton's Comics and Culture Radar, a podcast that's on the lookout for what's good to read and watch. If you don't know who Milton is, let's ask Kiefer Sutherland's father what he thinks.
Don't write this down, but I find Milton probably as boring as you find Milton. He's a little bit long-winded. He doesn't translate very well into our generation, and his jokes are terrible.
This episode, Milton's guest is Samuel George London. Samuel is a comic book writer and host of the podcast Comics for the Apocalypse. His miniseries, The S Factor, was just published by Action Lab Entertainment.
Sam, thank you for coming onto the podcast.
Absolute pleasure, Milton.
So you're here to talk about a number of things, but the primary hot off the press item that is of most interest to all of us is your new comic, The S Factor, which I had a chance to read very recently, enjoyed quite a lot.
Thanks.
Why don't you give us the pitch for the series for anyone who's not familiar with it yet?
Yeah, so it's basically about a superhero dating reality TV show with a dark underbelly. That's kind of the log line, basically. to expand upon that, it focuses on this underappreciated sidekick called Grey Fox, who, as I just mentioned, he feels underappreciated from his superior, who's called Dark Fox. This opportunity arises from the British Broadcasting Service, BBS rather than the BBC, to take part in a dating reality TV show for superheroes. And basically they'd rebrand him as a new superhero so that he can go out all on his own and leave his former superior behind in the dust to become the supreme superhero of London. Something isn't right, basically.
Right. And true to form of a reality TV show structure, I won't spoil it, but there is quite a twist in the perspective of the show and of the comic. And it's probably not what you will expect just from the log line. So I highly recommend everybody go through and read all four issues. And I believe all four issues are available now, right?
Yeah, that's right, on Comixology. If you just search for The Yes Factor, then it'll come up right there.
Could you tell us a little bit about the genesis of the idea? When did you come up with it? What was the kernel of the first idea? Are you a bit of a reality TV show fan, or is that just sort of a happy accident?
I guess it could be described as a happy accident. I first came up with the idea in 2018. it was actually a year where, for some reason, the Bachelor had been kind of airing on UK TV for some reason, like the American Bachelor, for some reason. And I kind of absorbed it through osmosis, I think, a little bit, kind of seeing tidbits here and there. I kind of just watching that and kind of seeing kind of the conflict between the people. It was quite, I thought, that's an interesting dynamic between people, because they're forced into this situation, and their emotions are basically turned up to 11 because the cameras are on. Some people want to make a show, some people hate the fact that some people are kind of making it a show and things like that, even though they've partaken in it themselves.
right.
Yeah, exactly. But it's an interesting setting, I think. I thought, how can I kind of use that in a comic context? And superheroes was the first thing that came to mind. And I'd always wanted to write a superhero comic, which I hadn't at that point. It was about trying to come up with this concept of what would kind of be the best setting. And I thought that, you know, having a dating reality TV show like The Bachelor would be kind of the best. And then it was about trying to figure out, how do you actually kind of merge that into a superhero world? What would be the motivations behind the producers of this? And things like that, which you find out in the comic, incidentally. But that's kind of the dark underbelly that I was talking about earlier. So I came up with that concept in 2018, and I actually ran a Kickstarter for this with the artist that we have on that drew it, Chris Panda. But unfortunately, that was unsuccessful, which was really disheartening at the time. However, as part of that, I was actually introduced to somebody that worked at Action Lab through that really liked the project and was surprised that it wasn't funded on Kickstarter. And she basically said that she'd be happy to submit it to the review board at Action Lab. And thankfully, it got through the review board there. Then, you know, come 2020, in the midst of a pandemic, we actually managed to get it published and get it out there. And it's just wonderful to finally have it out in the world.
Well, that's fantastic. And speaking as someone who has had a similar experience and noticed a number of peers who've had a similar experience, the quote unquote unsuccessful Kickstarters can sometimes turn out to be long run successes. I think we need to invent a term for the fail-success Kickstarter.
That's a good idea, actually. I think that'd be fantastic. I'm gonna have to rack my brains for that one, because there's got to be a term that we can come up with, like a ping pong success, I don't know, or something like that.
I like it. Now, you mentioned a love of superheroes, and that definitely comes through in the S Factor. In fact, I don't know about you, but as you're a comic creator, I don't know if you're plagued by this same issue that I have, but a lot of times when I'm reading a comic, I'm kind of having a two-track experience. Mm. I'm enjoying the comic on its own merits, and then I'm also simultaneously analyzing it. What lessons can I learn? What kind of craft is being done here? What would I have done in this same situation? And one of the thoughts I had fairly early on reading this comic was, oh my goodness, Sam, you're wasting all your great superhero ideas here. You've got this entire world that's coming through, and you've got a wide cast of characters. And ultimately, my worries were completely set aside. What would you say to the concept of, you know, I think other people could take the same idea and kind of give short shrift to the superheroes, and it'd be just like, okay, yeah, you know, we all know what a superhero is. Here's one, here's two, whatever. Whereas in your story, there's clearly, you know, an entire backstory and character between all of these contestants. How did you feel about fitting all of this into the structure you had?
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough, isn't it? Because it's about trying to strike the right balance of being able to actually create the thing, because the artist needs to be paid for a start. So if you come up with a 12 issue epic, then you eventually you've got to pay for that at some point, basically. Right. As the original creator of the idea, I mean, you don't really have that issue if you're an artist writer, but if you are just a writer, then you kind of, that is always in the back of your mind a little bit when creating a story, that you kind of, you've got to be efficient and effective with your storytelling, in that it can't be too large. Well, just at least at the beginning of your career, that is, which I'm in at the moment. Also at the same time, from a reader's perspective, I dislike kind of elongated storylines. They're like, well, unnecessarily elongated storylines. So I like to get to the nub of the story kind of straight away. So that obviously probably comes through in my writing, that I kind of just jump into it, basically. And as you mentioned, there's a whole cast of superheroes here that have clearly got a backstory of some kind. And, you know, there's even more of a backstory to Dark Fox and Grey Fox in that as well. You get a little bit of that at the beginning, but not much. So, I mean, it leaves me room to expand upon that. So what I've tried to do is try to give enough to the reader to connect the dots, but also at the same time, leave it open to interpretation, but also open for me as a writer to create more stories based upon those questions that readers must have.
Yeah, I think you really succeeded in that aspect of the story structure, because it really feels like the kind of thing that simultaneously it gave me exactly what I wanted for this story, but also left me wanting more. And that's kind of a hard thing to pull off without feeling that you've cheapened what you've got, because you don't want to arrive at the end of it and feel like, oh, you know, this is all just a setup for a sequel or something. Mm. And you don't get that feel at all with the S Factor. You get this great experience. And I don't know if you would like to continue it, but as a reader of it, I would like to see it continue.
Awesome.
And I want to ask you about, you say you're not a fan of elongated or overly elongated storytelling. Mm. How much of that are you naturally suited to as a reader or a writer, to smaller stories, or is it a side effect of the, let's just put it this way. In the past 10 years, there have been a number of comic projects that sort of stake out some territory in the first couple of issues that deliver some really giant premise that seems to promise a very fruitful 50 to 60 to 70 issue idea, and you get all excited for it. And then by the time you get to issue 3, they're already stalling. And it feels like, no, wait a minute, the kind of, you know, delivery here, what seems to be promised, is way out of balance with what you actually get. Mm-hmm. Where is your taste on that? Do you just purely like the shorter format, or have you just seen failures?
Yeah, I think it's just a case of kind of seeing failures, really. And as you kind of say there, you have comics that can kind of start off with, you know, the first 2 or 3 issues promising kind of this expansive world and things, which is great. But then, like, the preceding kind of 10, 20 issues can kind of be a little bit, oh, this is dragging. I'm just mentioned in the first couple of issues. That's pretty frustrating. I guess it's from being a frustrated comic fan a little bit. But it's, I think it's also reflected in my own personality, unfortunately, because I can be sometimes quite direct and kind of wanting to get to the nub of something rather than kind of savoring it, I guess, which is a double-edged sword, basically, because sometimes it's nice to savor these things. And I think it has absolutely been done right, where you have storylines that are very long and rightfully so, but I think they're more rare than common.
Yeah, and I think getting to the nub is kind of a strength of your writing in this example, at least, because in addition to the structural brevity of everything, there are a lot of pages in this that are almost wordless. No captions, no dialogue, mm-hmm. and most of the panels have dialogue that is extraordinarily succinct. You've got a very direct prose style with your dialogue, and I thought that worked really well.
Oh, thanks, man. That's really what I was going for, certainly in this comic, but I generally go for that anyway. I try to let the art speak for itself. I mean, particularly in the final issue, It's fairly wordless, that final issue. Chris has done an outstanding job with the art, and he's an incredible artist. And when you have somebody of that caliber who's able to have that facial acting, as well as the action-packed fight scenes and things like that, it's great to have that art just there speaking for itself.
Now, I'm not familiar. Is this your first collaboration with this artist?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
How did you partner up?
Yeah, with Chris. So Chris Panda is the guy's name. He's a Frenchman living in Germany. He's a brilliant artist, and I came across him, I think it was on Twitter. And he's done some work for IDW. I think was it for certainly for Comics Tribe. I know that he recently worked with Ryan K. Lindsay on She. He's done multiple covers for IDW for Star Trek versus Transformers and stuff like that, basically. When I was on the lookout for an artist for the S Factor, it was really about trying to find somebody that could do kind of just classic superhero art, really. And Chris kind of screams that, basically. On his website, he's actually got a whole host of covers where he's turned classic comic covers into female protagonists, he's just absolutely nails it, basically, on it. And as soon as I saw that, I thought, this is the guy that I need to get. And so I contacted Chris, and thankfully he was available, and he's very collaborative and very accommodating to work with. So it was a match made in heaven for me.
Yeah, and you're absolutely correct. His style is a perfect fit for the material. I mean, it feels like, straight out of Big Two, modern superhero comic art storytelling. So it really fit.
Oh yeah, massively. And I'm so surprised that he hasn't been picked up by the Big Two. Because he is on the lookout kind of for that as well, I'm sure when the right story comes along that they'll pick him up. Well, I mean, it's kind of difficult at the moment, but hopefully that time will come.
So you said that the reality TV show connection here is maybe a little bit of a happy accident. Do you have a favorite reality TV show?
I don't know if it's favorite. I'm trying to think of a nice analogy, but the only analogy I can think of is kind of looking at a car crash, really. So it's kind of like, you don't want to look, but you can't help but kind of, looking out of the corner of your eye as you drive past, that kind of thing. Which is terrible, but it's interesting. In the UK, we kind of have equivalents to the US. So our equivalent of what's the one in New Jersey? Jersey Shore, is it, or something?
Oh, yeah.
Jersey Shores. So our equivalent, we've got two, actually. So the first one is The Only Way is Essex. And Essex is a county that's just kind of, it's northeast of London, and they've got quite a strong accent, let's say, and they're well known as people in Jersey Shore, at least, for having orange skin and kind of having bucket loads of makeup on and things like that. Okay. And it's just like, when you look at the conversations on that show, it's like, what are you talking about? Like, you guys are nuts. And then it can sometimes turn into fights and things like that. So that's kind of fun to watch for a few minutes, I think. I don't understand anybody that can watch that for longer than a few minutes, and kind of not you know, slam their head against the table. It's incredible. But then at the same time, I tell you what's really interesting. So my wife is French, and they have this reality TV show in France that basically translates to Love in the Field. And it's about farmers trying to find love, right?
Okay.
But when you watch it, it's actually really good because it's very heartfelt. It's not about creating arguments and things like this. It's actually about trying to help farmers that are generally, that can be very lonely in their occupation and find it difficult to find love because they don't always have the time to kind of go on dating events and things like this, and they're busy farming. They go on dates with, I think it's about 3 or 4 people, I think, like multiple dates. But it's quite clear that the main aim is to help the farmer and the people that are involved to actually find some sort of relationship rather than trying to create conflict. Not all dating reality TV show is bad, and well, not all reality TV is bad. I think there are some good ones out there, it's an interesting concept.
I wanted to ask you, as a person in the UK, as an outsider perceiving your culture from the US perspective, it seemed to me at least that the UK is more enraptured by the reality TV show format. Am I wrong about that?
Nah, not at all. We've gone all out on it, basically.
Just anecdotally, I don't know if it's as popular now as it was in its prime, mm-hmm. but I'm a little bit of an Anglophile myself, and I follow a lot of people on social media from the UK, and just I would notice at some seemingly random point to me, all of these people would be talking about a person with the same name, and they would just refer to this person by their first name, and it would just be assumed that everybody would know what we're all talking about here, and it would turn out to be that would be the person that was performing on the X Factor.
Oh, the S Factor, sorry. Or do you mean the X Factor, sorry?
Did I say the S Factor? Yeah. I've got it on the brain. Yeah. No, I meant the X Factor, the singing competition.
Yes, absolutely. That is well up there. Although in recent years, just in the past couple of years, it's actually kind of been going downhill in its ratings. But, you know, you've still got the X Factor. You've got Britain's Got Talent, equivalent obviously being America's Got Talent. You've also got The Voice, of course, which you guys have got, I think, as well, have you? You must do. And then you've just got all of the regular reality TV shows, like The Only Way is Essex, Geordie Shore, which is kind of a take on Jersey Shore as well. It's in the north of England. We were one of the first ones to take on the Dutch program Big Brother, we're a big tabloid society over here, so kind of having gossip from reality TV shows is kind of prime water cooler talk in the UK, certainly. I'm not really one to be gossiping myself, but I know plenty of people that do.
The one out of all the ones you mentioned that I actually became a bit of a fan of for a number of years was actually the UK version of Big Brother.
Right.
I personally am not really a fan of the reality TV show genre generally, mm-hmm. But someone turned me on to the UK version of Big Brother, and I was endlessly fascinated by it because the American version is some sort of like competition show with a lot of very pretty people. That, you know, they try to do, you know, romantic triangles and so forth and everything. And it's all about scoring points and voting things. Whereas the UK version is like a sociology experiment. Mm-hmm. And they bring folks together from lots of different socioeconomic backgrounds, and they don't get along. And it's almost like watching like an anthropological, you know, David Attenborough special, but about the human animal, as opposed to, you know, a reality show.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was the original idea with Big Brother. I believe it was really kind of almost like a psychological experiment. Obviously as soon as kind of advertisers and producers get their hands on it, it turns into something else just to chase ratings basically. But it's a fascinating genre of TV. And in my research, actually, I did find some quite worrying research that those that watch more reality TV show actually have more emotional arguments basically, and have more variation in their emotions as well, as a direct result of having watched more reality TV, because they think that the way to solve an argument is to shout at each other. You know, instead of an actual like normal person conflict resolution, where you kind of you try to calm yourself down if you are getting angry and things, and try to actually kind of have some sort of resolution rather than just shouting at each other, slamming doors, and then kind of, you know, going to go do something crazy, like, I don't know, like throw a chair through a window or something like I've seen on reality TV before. It's quite worrying. So obviously that's kind of when you've only got particular types of reality TV. And going back to the example of the French reality TV show that I was talking about earlier, where it's quite clear that their motivation is to create love between the contestants rather than having any conflict, then obviously that's something that's very positive. And believe it or not, this is the longest running TV show in France, I believe. Oh, wow. I think it's been going like 20 years, and it's the same number of ratings that they've had throughout the whole thing. So it's obviously striking a chord that, you know, you don't always need to try and chase conflict and things, that if your heart is in the right place, then it's potentially, you know, quite good.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So we've talked a little bit about contrasting American and UK culture in terms of how we react to reality television. There's another obvious dimension. In television, the scale is so vastly different. A lot of fans of UK TV from the US are often drawn to the briefer runs of programs, because so many American programs run far too long. And I'm wondering, is that entirely economical, or does UK culture have a bit of that Sam London knack for storytelling?
Perhaps. It might kind of be intrinsic to British society. It just seems that I'm not sure it's entirely economical, because, I mean, obviously the reason that American TV does that is in order to have more advertising on those shows.
Yeah.
Basically, if it's not broke, don't fix it. And kind of there's no bigger example of that than The Walking Dead, I think. And they're really milking it for all it's worth now. Which is crazy. Like, I've seen that they've got The Walking Dead World Beyond now, which is like the third series, the second spin-off of the original.
Oh my goodness.
Right? So they're really starting to milk it. And, you know, the games are basically all the same. and it's just, I don't know, they're really milking it on that. But yeah, with the UK, I think there is kind of a real focus on trying to just tell the story that you want to tell and then move on. Basically, that's really what we try to do.
Now, teach me a little bit about the differences in the cultures, specifically to contemporary comics. I'm not too familiar with what would be more popular in the UK these days in the world of comics. My limited understanding of UK comics is just that, you know, in the 80s we stole all of your talent over here, but other than that, I'm afraid I'm woefully ignorant of trends in British comics. Give me a little bit of the lay of the land.
I mean, it's still very kind of DC Marvel centric, all of it, to be honest. Of course you have a lot of the independent comics coming through, but that's still kind of coming from an American focus at the same time, kind of through Image and things like that. But of course, then on the flip side, you've got 2000 AD and comics like that that are still staples. You can still find them in most convenience stores. 2000 AD, which is you know, thankful that they're still going pretty strong with it. Like, you don't just find them in comic shops, because when I was a kid, you did have a lot of comics in convenience stores, and it wasn't just comic shops. But now it's really kind of, you can only find comics in comic shops. And in convenience stores or supermarkets, it's still just like 2000 AD, the Beano, and like loads of magazines, basically. certainly in comic shops. I mean, there has been quite a bit of a push for indie comics as well. So, of course, you've kind of got Indian small press sections in comic shops as well, where they try to promote them. But ultimately, comic shops are businesses, and they need to sell stuff in order to stay viable. And the things that sell are still just DC and Marvel titles for the most part, really.
Now, I'm going to move on to other topics, but I do have one other US-UK contrast question for you. And this one's entirely self-serving. I hope other people will be entertained by your answer as well. But I do have a project I'm going to be writing soon that takes place in the UK. What do outsiders who try to write stories set in the UK get wrong? What do they miss? What do they get wrong?
Let me think. I'm trying to think of examples of, I mean, I think certainly roads and housing often gets kind of confused. And I can't think of any examples for comics, but for TV, it sticks out like a sore thumb, basically. recently, I tell you what, during this whole pandemic, my wife and I we've actually rewatched Lost for some reason. I don't know why. It was on Amazon Prime, and we thought, you know, let's rewatch it again. In the cut scenes where, you know, Desmond is supposedly in the UK, it's like, that's definitely not the UK. That's definitely an American street made out to look like it's the UK, and like stuff like that. So yeah, when you are kind of doing your research and kind of providing your artist with descriptions and things, just go onto Google Maps, honestly. Go onto Google Maps, yeah. Get Street View, and then send them a print screen of what an actual UK street looks like, what the cars look like as well. There are not very many pickups in the UK, not at all. It tends to be hatchbacks and people movers, or soccer mum cars, that's basically it. And then I think maybe the other thing is perhaps maybe sometimes the language. this certainly sticks out from American films that have supposed British people in it. And like the Cockney slang is completely, not correct. Even just the slang is just, what are you doing? that's not what that means. Like, I mean, the Boys is a really good series, of course. I'm talking about the TV series. But sometimes the language that Carl Urban is using is just like, that's not it. And I'd have thought that somebody like Carl Urban, and although he's a Kiwi, he'd kind of know that, and I sometimes his accent is appalling.
Oh goodness.
It's like, dude, he sounds like Dick Van Dyke from Mary Poppins,
Oh my goodness.
Sometimes, not all the time, but just sometimes it's like, oh, I just wish that they just keep your Kiwi accent, just make him a Kiwi for the TV series. It doesn't matter.
Right.
It wouldn't have mattered, I don't think. I don't know. yeah, certainly just the slang is often the thing, and the streets, I think.
So in addition to being a comic creator, you're also a podcaster, and I expect that most of the folks listening to this episode will may have heard your podcast, but for those who haven't, it's got a very intriguing format. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so it's called Comics for the Apocalypse, and I've had the pleasure of having you on, Milton, so folks, go check that out. But basically, I interview guests about what comics they take into the apocalypse. As you know, the guests, they choose a random number between 1 and 6, and then that kind of sets what apocalypse situation they're in, and then that's where we start off the conversation, and then it leads in to what comics they actually choose to take into the apocalypse. And I ask you things like, what was the first comic that you read? What's the funniest comic, the saddest comic, and your favorite cover, the most meaningful comic, the best comic of all time, and then what comic would you, if you could only take one comic into the apocalypse, which would it be? And that's not always the same as their favorite comic. It's a really fun ride to get into.
So how did you come up with the concept for Comics for the Apocalypse?
Yeah, so the concept actually comes from Desert Island Discs. Do you know that one at all?
I think it's self-explanatory, but is there a specific podcast that uses that, or are you just referring to the general?
So it's actually it's a radio show. It's a BBC radio show that is been running since the mid 40s, basically. So it's, gosh, what's that? That's almost coming up like 80 years old. This TV show, which is crazy when you think about it. They essentially ask their guests about what music that they'd take with them onto a desert island. They ask for eight tracks, and through their choices, they talk about their life, essentially. And the interviewer asks them about their life, there's no specific questions like I'm asking. But one song kind of reminds them about their childhood, and then the next one reminds them about being at university. The next one reminds them about being at their wedding and the birth of their child and stuff like that, and like leads them up to where they are today, basically. It's just an amazing insight into well-known people. So yeah, definitely search for that, Desert Island Discs, and they've had all sorts of people on there, you know, from David Attenborough himself to John Cleese and, you know, J.K. Rowling and everybody in between. It's really, really fascinating. But taking that concept into comics, I just thought, how does that work? And, you know, the best way is to kind of be kind of as fictionalized as possible, and apocalypse is always a fun thing to kind of chew the fat on. So, you know, comics for the apocalypse.
Awesome. Now, apocalyptic or dystopian themes or stories, are those things that you're naturally a fan of?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. I only got into comics, gosh, when was it? About 2014, maybe. So I'm, you know, a newbie as far as it goes, really. But the reason that I got into it was The Walking Dead. So having watched the show, I found out that it was a comic, and so then I ended up reading the comic itself, which I enjoyed more. then, you know, discovered the rest of the work of Robert Kirkman's work, and discovered Mark Miller, and then, you know, Alan Moore and Grant Morrison and all the rest of them, really. That originally opened up my mind. But I'm always happy to look at somebody's take on an apocalypse, and different apocalypses as well, and even kind of dual apocalypses, you know, and which The Walking Dead was apparently originally pitched as, that it was a zombie apocalypse with an alien invasion, wasn't it? That's how he pitched it and got its publication. But then he was like, you know, there's not going to be any aliens, by the way. Apparently.
So you've just revealed that you probably got you've got to be in the running for the Guinness Book of World Records for the briefest amount of time between discovering a medium and becoming published in that medium. That's a pretty impressive time span. So congratulations on that.
Thanks, man. Yeah. I don't know. I really dove into comics and read everything that took my fancy. It was just, I just felt the need to write something, because I'd attempted to write novels and things in the past, but I'd never been able to follow through with it. But when I first came up with the idea for my first comic, Milford Green, which is a Victorian alien story, it just flew out of me, you know. It was awesome. But when I do get down to writing a comic now, I just feel like it just flows out of me. It feels great when I'm writing a comic. So I'm just happy that I've managed to found a medium that I can actually create something.
So have you had anyone turn the tables on you and put you through your own format on the show?
Not yet. I'm saving that one. We'll see when I manage to get that to happen. But it will happen eventually, I think.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. I look forward to that. So as someone who's got a little bit of the market cornered on the world of the apocalypse, do you feel like you've got some beef with the year 2020 in general, kind of horning in on your territory here?
Definitely. Now that it's an actual reality, it's not so nice. it's been, for the most part, quite a depressing year. There've been some good things come out of it, but it's been a very trying year for everybody, and just my heart goes out to everybody that it's dramatically affected. I just hope that we're able to make things better for next year.
Indeed. Well, let me steer us back real briefly here to the world of comics and your craft specifically. What is your writing process? What kind of tools do you use?
So for me, my initial starting point is that I try to pin down an outline. And again, a brief outline. I generally use the 8-point story arc. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I have not heard that one. No,
But you can just Google it, 8-point story arc. But it's basically the story arc that Dan Harmon uses for Rick and Morty and Community and things like that. Just to pin down what the story actually is trying to say, and just making sure that you get all the beats in there. So I start off with trying to set out an 8-point story arc. And then from there, once I've pinned that down, then I'll go about just starting writing. But the way that I write, I use a writing table. And not as in like a desk, I mean an actual table in a Word document, for instance. Okay. And I've got, how many rows? Three columns, in total. So the first column is your page and panel. So when it says 1.1 in that column, it means the first page, first panel. And then you have 1.2, 1.3, and things like that for what panel it's going to be. And then the next column from there, I've got the description of that column. And then the last one is the dialogue. And the reason that I use that format in particular is because I can just see it across the page. Because when I read other people's standard scripts, which are like film scripts, going vertically, I can't visualize it as well for some reason. So having the table format where you have it going right across the page, so horizontally, rather than having to write reads vertically, just helps me visualize, you know, how the page is going to look, what the actual content of the page as well. Again, it's very kind of clear and concise in my head. And the feedback that I've had from artists is that it's actually quite helpful for them having it in a table like that. That's how I write. And then once I've done a first draft, then I send it to my my editor, Nicole DeAndrea, who then helps me pin down what's perhaps missing, and also helps me out with dialogue as well, just in terms of kind of grammar, but also you know, when grammar isn't needed, kind of is that how the character should sound and things like that. Then once I get that back from Nicole, then I might kind of do a few more polishes and things like that, and then I'll send it to my artist, and then kind of the collaboration process starts from there. And it's every artist is different in terms of if they want to do it through Twitter or they want to do it on just through email or WhatsApp or something like that, but it's always just a going back and forth in terms of them actually sketching out the pages, nailing down the layout and kind of the actions and things, and then obviously going into the full detail.
So what would be your key piece of advice for persons wanting to create comics from your personal lessons learned? What if you had one key piece of advice or two, what would they be?
Start small. like all of these endeavors, don't go all out thinking that you're going to write a Lord of the Rings trilogy straight off the bat, or kind of your Watchmen or anything like that. It's you're better off starting small. You can have those ideas kind of brewing in the background, like, you know, you've got this 12 issue arc that you want to get out there and things, but start small. Try and get involved in anthologies where the storylines tend to be 4 to 8 pages long. I highly recommend trying to use some sort of story structure formula at the start, at least. The one that I mentioned before, again, is the 8-point story arc. And to do that's just really useful to help you gain the skills of trying to figure out how a story should actually be. And with that, because it's 8 points, you can actually do it so that each point is a page, basically. And so you just have an 8-page story right there. And it can be just anything as simple as you know, a kid going to the woods to go on his own imaginary adventure and then ending up back home. You know, it doesn't have to be a high stakes sci-fi epic or something like that. It just has to be something simple, just so that you can start your storytelling skills to try and sharpen them. So start small, get in touch with anthology series to try and get involved in those, because they're always looking for stories. And then once you've got published and things like that through those anthologies, then you can kind of start to expand on that. You can, of course, just go straight to Kickstarter and try and go from there. Doesn't work for everybody, but it works for a lot of people, myself included. Kickstarter is a great place to get your comics if you can't get them published elsewhere.
Well, these are all fantastic bits of advice, all of which I wish I had known before I first started writing comics. So anyone out there who's listening to this, who's considering it, definitely heed Sam's words here.
Thanks, Milton. Much appreciated.
So are you at liberty to tell us anything about any other projects you have currently brewing?
I'm currently working on my latest Kickstarter, which was funded in, when was it, May? It was May that it was funded. Access Denied. So that's currently in the works. And then other than that, I'm trying to, my time's really limited at the moment, with work and childcare and, family and things like that. So, unfortunately I'm not really writing that much right now. I've got a few ideas in the works, that I'm working on, but those probably won't come to fruition until next year, I think. I've got plenty of back catalogue for people to check out as well, if they want to. I'll keep you posted, Milton.
Cool. And to close out, I have one question that I ask everybody. The title of the podcast, Milton's Comics and Culture Radar. What's on your radar? What are you reading? What are you watching that you can recommend?
At the moment, I am reading Kill Them All by Kyle Starks, which is basically about, what's the best way to describe it? Kyle is an exceedingly funny guy, and so just his dialogue is hilarious, and it's always kind of, you know, action comedy, basically. But it's about this, probably about 30 pages in, but it seems to be about this woman who this girl actually that went missing, and then years later it seems that she's entangled in some sort of organized crime, and then she's kind of exiled from this, and then it's about her getting revenge or something like that. Basically, I haven't explained it very well because I haven't read it, basically, but I'm reading that at the moment, and it's just hilarious. So that's what I'm reading right now. Other than that, I am currently watching Handmaid's Tale, which is very timely and very scary at the same time. Because, you know, things might be happening as we speak in that respect. What else am I reading? I'm starting to read a novel by this guy called Graham Hancock, and it's called War God. So I don't know if you've heard of Graham Hancock before, but he's this kind of alternative archaeologist guy. He's more of a journalist and a reporter, and reports on kind of alternative theories on archaeology and things. He's got a very interesting take. One of his novels, War God, is about the conquistadors coming over to South America, and kind of, you know, basically ransacking the whole place. But he also presents the fact that, you know, when Cortez came to Mexico and kind of, you know, this mass genocide of the Aztecs and the Mayans, the Aztecs were actually kind of dictators as it was. They were actually really bad people at the same time. You know, they're sacrificing many, many people. And I think it was like 80,000 that the leader of the Aztecs ended up sacrificing in the end. And he was kind of pretty mad on hallucinogenic drugs at the time, I think.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was a bit of a FUBAR situation. Like, basically the common people of the Aztecs and the Mayans at the time were screwed either way, which really sucks. He's written a novel based on that, and it's from the perspective of the female translator that they used, because the Mayans spoke a different language and the Aztecians spoke a different language, and obviously the Spaniards spoke Spanish, but she spoke the Mayan language and the Aztecian language, and it only took her like 2 or 3 weeks to learn Spanish or something, and she ended up being the translator for all of them to try and negotiate, and then obviously it ended up bad because it ended up in a war, but you know, it's from her perspective, basically, and it's just really interesting.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for those recommendations, and thank you for coming onto the program. Before I let you go, could you just let us know where is the best place to find you on the internet?
Best place is Twitter, under Samuel G. London. And if you go there, then you'll be able to end up everywhere else, such as my Comixology page, my Kickstarter page. I'm also on Instagram. I don't post as often as I do on Twitter, which is also under Samuel G. London at the same time. And then if you want to check out my independently self-published comics, then if you go to signalcomics.com, then you'll be able to check them out there as well.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for coming onto the program.
My pleasure, Milton.